Hello and welcome to Conversations from the ANF Network. In this episode, I speak to adult adoptee Courtney Grace. She shares her experience of adoption and is frank in relation to the challenges she faced growing up and re-entering the care system as a teenager. Courtney Grace is honest and frank about the impact of her experiences and the challenges that she navigated. As always, if you've experienced of adoption, fostering or special guardianship from any perspective, personal or professional, and would like to share that on the podcast, please get in touch through the Facebook page, the app formerly known as Twitter, or you can email us at aandfpodcast@gmail.com.
My name's Courtney Grace. I am a adult adoptee now, and I'm here to speak about my adoption story.
Excellent. So we've chatted a little bit before we started, Courtney, so I know a little bit about you, but can you sort of start at the beginning and really in terms of, you know, your experience of, do you know why you came into care? What's your early memories of being adopted, of realizing you're adopted and making sense of if that's different to your friends and other children?
Of course, yeah. So I didn't find out why I was adopted until I became an adult, and thankfully as well, because it gave me a lot of appreciation for what my biological mother went through. In my opinion, she was an extremely exploited child, and she was also under social services at the time of my adoption, and I will always stand with the opinion that social services picked which child to save, and they picked the one in utero instead of her. And yeah, that was back in 1998 when I was born. I wasn't adopted till 1999. It was either December or September of 99. I was adopted to a Christian couple who were very middle class, and they were, my adopted mom was lovely. There was so much love there. And my adopted father was your very stereotypical working man who, you know, had a very good job. He stayed there all his life. He loved it. And yeah, they adopted me 3 years after they adopted me, or maybe four, in 2002, anyway, they adopted he's not my biological brother, but he's my brother. So they adopted my brother. And we were just a happy family for about 18 months. I always knew I was adopted. They never hid that from me. It was never anything that, like, my adoption day was never celebrated. I didn't really know when that was until I looked at my adoption certificate. But it was, I always knew I was adopted. Interestingly, they changed my name to Grace because, well, they wanted Christian names for their children. And it was by the grace of God they got me and all of this, which every time, like, my name change was mentioned, it was always that rhetoric that was repeated. I didn't really think much about, like, my friends. As far as I was concerned, I had the best parents in the world, and my friends, like, my best friend, she might hurt me a bit for saying this, but her family's a bit dysfunctional. So I wasn't ever really very, it wasn't much that my family always looked very functional compared to anything else that was going on with my friends. So yeah, that was very early years. When I was six, the story does take a turn. When I was 6 years old, though, so about 18 months after they adopted my little brother, my adopted mom was tragically killed in a car accident, which is what changed my family forever, to be quite honest with you. Everybody was grieving, everybody was hurting. It was definitely a very traumatic time, understandably. I mean, I couldn't imagine losing my partner, and my adopted father lost the love of his life. And yeah, that's where in my opinion, that's where my story starts. It doesn't actually start with my adoption. It kind of starts 6 years later with that. I'm trying to think where to go now. She died. I was very angry after that. People could definitely describe me as a very angry little girl. I didn't really have the best coping skills, understandably. I didn't really know how to put my grief, especially because I didn't realize, like, I now know as an adult, I wasn't just grieving my adopted mom. I was grieving every female caregiver I'd lost up until that point. Or at least my body was, even if I wasn't. So yeah, that was interesting actually. It definitely shaped my family and my entire life. She left a huge hole in everybody's heart that she touched. She's an incredible woman. It was actually her 19th anniversary, on the 3rd, so it'll be 20 years next year, which is just, yeah, 20 years, that's insane. I didn't realize how angry I was until I started calming down as an adult, obviously, but we'll get to that bit later. So I was an angry child. My adopted dad, I don't think he particularly knew how to deal with it. So we'd had my adopted uncle had also died, and my adopted auntie's method for her children was to just shield them in love, where my adopted father, I don't really think we had that. I think he was trying to do his own version of that, but unfortunately, women's work as it was, so like all the cuddling and the kissing and the comfort often goes unnoticed. So I don't think he realized how much was needed. And he was still working, bless him. He kept down his job still that entire time. He took time off, obviously, to grieve, and then he stuck in with hiring nannies. And we had two nannies, actually, which were lovely women. I can't fault them. They stayed until we were one only worked for about 2 years, and then the next one worked for, well, until I was about 10, maybe. It was before I finished primary school. Continued with my adopted family, had all the support of my adopted mother's family. That never stopped, really, what during my childhood at all. It was, even though that the death was there, we were trying to make function of it for the sake of the children. I can really see how that was happening. They had concerns of my behaviour, reasonable concerns of my behaviour, even before my teenage years, really.
You
So
described
no.
yourself as a angry child, and I was thinking that's a that covers a lot of, or well, it's a sort of a vague term, isn't it? If I'm being honest with you, do you feel comfortable sort of sharing what that would look like and how, well, or maybe how people would characterize that, and what sense was anyone trying to make of that?
I think now, because of the push for mental health, even though I don't believe RAD exists as a diagnosis at all, I think it's just a traumatized child shown reaction. I
So that's
think
reactive attachment disorder, just for
yeah.
people who may not know. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. I think it would have got described as RAD. Anything that I was asked to do, it was an explosion. It wasn't going to happen. It was just pure, anger. I was often lying about stuff, mainly because of fear of being punished and the punishments that we went through. But it was over petty stuff. Like, my adopted dad's going to laugh at this story. So I convinced my adopted dad that my little brother was the one who got rid of all the onion peel and just left it on the pantry floor, to which my little brother had to clean my bedroom because I picked it up. But no, it was me, Dad. I didn't want to pick up I didn't want to pick up the peel. And yeah, it was me. And my adopted brother loves the fact that I've now told.
Confessed.
My adopted dad will still never believe. He still swears that it wasn't. But yeah, it was just really silly stuff like that. You know, like take normal silly kid compulsion and put it with adult emotions and feelings and anger and just pure rage. It was slamming doors. I was just one of those. I was very understandable.
Yeah, I mean, and to get a diagnosis or to be kind of considered to have reactive attachment disorder, then it's out well outside of normal, or you know, the sort of the normal child tantrum, or you know, and looking back now, it sounds like you've, I mean, it sounds like you've got quite an interesting perspective on that. And you can you see now what that was about in a way that you just wasn't available to you at the time.
Of course, yeah, my emotional needs weren't being met. If you follow a really interesting theory that I've liked enjoying learning about is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So you've got your base needs, which are like food, shelter, And then you've got your next needs and so on to reach self-actualization. So if your first level isn't being met, you're not going to have a calm and willing to reason child, basically. And in my opinion, from my adopted mom dying, my first needs of love and support would never be met. So of course you had, a very angry child. I was never given the words to describe my feelings, where now, like, I think children now, we take it for granted that they go through feelings charts and all of this, where this wasn't existing in the early noughties. Like, it just didn't happen at all. It was like, yeah, I think especially for boomer parents, I think I'll say that they're yeah, it's very much like you don't speak about your emotions. You don't go through your feelings. It's just you're being naughty. You're a naughty child. And that's definitely what I got labelled as a lot of the time, because, you know, my cousins and my other sibling was just so easy. And yet you're so naughty, Grace. You're just a naughty child. So there's definite reasons for it. I can see now as an adult. I can also see now as an adult how my behavior was so inappropriate and why it had my relevant adult so worried. But once again, if you're not reaching the first needs, you're not going to have a child who can communicate and can effectively say what's going on inside their heads.
And a child is a child, you know, in one sense that we can't children are immature, they're developing, they're growing, and they're just responding to the world that they find themselves in. And, you know, I'm no psychologist, so I'm not going to pretend, but thinking of you in terms of a child who's experienced significant loss, on like, it's not, you know, it's loss laid upon loss laid upon loss. And the, how can there not be some sort of emotional impact of that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there was bound to be emotional impact. I just don't think anyone thought it would be quite impactful, if that makes sense. Which, yeah, even looking back now, like thinking about some of the stuff I did, I'm just questioning why, but also trying to remember that I was eight. I was literally 8 years old at the time of some of this stuff. So...
yeah, and I mean, I guess as well, you think in terms of acceptable ways for children to behave. So, you know, you can say, well, oh, this child has experienced loss, and therefore it would be appropriate that they are sad. Mm-hmm. But no one likes angry children.
Yeah, no, I think anger has become a very unacceptable emotion, when in reality it's a completely acceptable emotion. It's just where you put your anger is where the appropriateness not lies.
But I mean, and I was just thinking there as you were talking as well, you're set in a context of a family that's experienced significant loss as well, sudden significant loss. So no one is probably doing very well at that point.
No, nobody was. Nobody was at all. We were all we were all struggling. Even, well, everybody was. My mother was the glue, effectively. She was I describe her as an angel. Like, I've always, you go through the what ifs, don't you? Like, what if it was somebody else, or what if it was somebody else's family? What if she never died? Like, there were so many variables. Like, if she never died, a lot of stuff probably wouldn't have happened, but then it could have all happened exactly the way it happened the first time with her death. So it's
So maybe paint a picture of what, you know, this little girl starts to become a young adult. She turns into, you know, adolescence arrives, and what can you recall, sort of like that moving into high school, that kind of that growing sense of making sense of the world and identity, who am I, all that kind of stuff. Is that all kind of then crashing into you?
Yes. So because of my, because of my low moods all the time, I found emo music very, very relatable, which obviously doesn't really go with the Christian message. So there were concerns arising from the way I was dressing and the way I was like looking. I'm very much a little goth girl. I know I'm wearing like a green hoodie at the moment, but it's give me a headbanger and some mosh pits any day and I'm happy. I was really discovering myself as quite a confident young girl. My hormones and my emotions were horrendous. I couldn't control anything. I got into a lot of trouble for fighting in school and just general disrespect. I think I spat at a teacher once, which I really wouldn't recommend. It was honestly disgusting behavior what I was doing, but there was genuine reasons for it. Like nobody had communicated or taught me how to be, or like by this point I'd gone through CAMHS quite a few times. I've gone through grief counseling and everything. Interestingly, my adoption was never mentioned in any of this, only the loss of my adopted mother, sorry. So the initial relinquishment was just kind of swept under the rug and forgotten about. And then when I turned, well, a few weeks before my 12th or 13th birthday, I get a bit confused. I went back to foster care through nobody's fault, really. It was a difficult situation. There was another child to think about, obviously, in the household, and it just couldn't it couldn't go on with the way it was going. I was either going to self-delete or run away and get kidnapped, which was the only ways that that was going. My behavior was incredibly unsafe. I was hanging around with much older people. Well, men, not women, to be quite honest, and that they were not safe people at all. But I, in my opinion, my family was not the safe people because they wouldn't let me do stuff and everything. I was just too young for, which I can understand why a 12-year-old's too young for a lot of the stuff that I was asking for now, because I was. But try telling a child who thinks they're an adult that. There was no reasoning. It was my way or no way. I'm very much like my adopted father, which is weird. We're both stubborn, but in opposite directions. If you didn't know I was adopted, you would think that we were related. Apparently, I have the same eyes as him as well, which I think that's only because I've got a hooded eyelid. But yeah. Teenage years got very, very complicated in foster care. Obviously, the exploitation of myself was still going on. That didn't really stop until I became an adult and nobody wanted to exploit me anymore. But yeah, it was lonely, I think is a word I'm going to use. I had my needs met in foster care, but once again, my emotional needs were never being met. And they continued that way until Well, until about 3 4 years ago when I moved up north, but that comes a bit later in the story again.
Can I sort of just backpedal a bit? Because I feel like you've covered an awful lot of ground, and I know that it's not easy. And we're mindful that there's a lot of other people in the story, and I know you're very keen to be respectful towards them, which I think is very commendable. But listening in, that's a big deal. It's another loss, and I was really interested in the fact you said there that CAMHS had never joined the dots between, this primal wound removal from mum or however that worked, and then loss of replacement mum, well, loss of foster carer, probably a woman, then loss of mum, and then just kind of playing it out as just not joining the dots. I mean, do you look back now and think? And I don't want you to, I'm not looking for you to say anything salacious or point the finger and go, but you must look and go, crikey, I fell through the net there. I really did.
I was a child who just got assumed because I think it was a class thing. I think because I was in a very well-off family, they just assume that these issues that I'm having must just be a phase or whatever. And CAMHS don't particularly like to label children. So when you say you're depressed, they'll be like, no, it's a low mood. We call it a low mood. You're not suicidal. You're just in a low mood at the moment. And it's very, I think I find them very, what's the word? They don't validate. They're very invalidating of what the child is saying to them as well. So it wasn't helpful, particularly to go through CAMHS. And I was like, look, let's face it, I was failed as a child systematically. That there's no other way around that. That's as blunt as that one gets, unfortunately. And I don't think it's anybody's fault per se. I think it was just the time it was that it was situational, wasn't it? I mean, that there's a lot of professionals who see certain families and assume that they're a certain way, when in reality, you don't know what's going behind closed doors. I mean, by this point, we did have social services involved as well, and social services were pushing for some things that my caregivers were not happy for, and vice versa, and the communication just got lost in between a head wall between my adopted father and like social services and CAMHS. It just kind of it yeah that's I was systematically failed. There's no two way around that. Even when I went into foster care, when I thought things would get better, it was still systematic failings. There's nothing around that one. I don't know how to make that sound pretty.
No,
There's
well, I work in foster care, and I was thinking, well, it's easy to sort of step away from it and go, well, yeah, it's clearly you were. There's no ifs or buts about that. But then I also think then, well, what do you do with a 12, 13, 14-year-old who says, I'm an adult, or I think I'm an adult, I'm going to do what I want? And I mean, what would you have done differently? If you could have been the adult in the room, what I mean, this is maybe an impossible question, so I shouldn't ask it, but what do you think
I
should have been done?
was, well, I was threatened quite a bit with controlled accommodation. So it's when they put you in, no, secure accommodation, sorry. I was threatened a lot with secure accommodation. I would stop threatening children with that. I think if you've got an exploited child who has had little to no freedoms and has spent most of their life just scaving around the truth to get what freedom they have, you've got an extremely intelligent child there. That not necessarily that children manipulate to get what they want, because I don't believe that children can manipulate adults, but that I don't know how to say manipulate without using the word manipulate.
Well, it's the idea maybe that it's a strategy, isn't it? Children employ strategies to get what they need.
Of course, yeah. And I needed to go out and I needed to be with people that I thought cared about me, as opposed to people that I just didn't think liked me very much, because my foster carers didn't like drive me to school or anything. It was very much like, you come home, you sleep here, here's your food, you've got free rein pretty much the rest of the time. And I mean, they were lovely people. They made Christmas very nice and my birthday very nice, and I can't really fault them for that. But it wasn't necessarily the support I needed. I needed shrouding in love. And I was given people whose job it is to look after me and feed me, which, yeah, that's what foster care is. But yeah, I think there was a lot of things that would have been done differently if I was my foster carer. I know it's difficult because you can't, that you are very stuck with what you can do by law as a foster parent, obviously. But simple stuff. So, like when they went out for family meals, I was never invited. And yet, my foster carers were invited to my wedding and my birthday parties and everything. And it was just a bit, okay, yeah, but I'm not part of your family. So, yay. Of course, I went to go and find my own family, which, yeah, that's by the by.
I mean, so you're describing a child who's being failed by the system. They're sort of moving towards aging out of the system. So, tell me a bit as you started to move towards sort of leaving care, independent living. What was
I that's an interesting story. My social worker, I think, was getting a bit fed up because I was running away a decent chunk there. The police looking out for me one or two nights a week at least. Not over a long time. I mean, I think this was only over a month or two. It was over my 16th birthday. So a few weeks after that, went for a LAC review. And they informed me that I either tell them where I'm living or, we're going to be in serious trouble. We'll have to send the police to follow you and stuff like this. So then I informed them where I was living, which was with a much older man. I believe he was 32. He's the man I was living with is old enough to be my biological father, just to give you an idea of the age gap between us at that point, because he is the same age as my biological father. And my social worker told me how to sign myself out of my order so I could go live with him and still keep all my foster like care leaver perks, so like your gym pass, your setting up home grants. And I just thought this was a fabulous idea because I still get all this money, except now because I'm living independently, the money that they were paying. So the way it works when you're 16, under social services, you get income support, even under the new universal credit, I believe you get income support, which is £55 a week, well, alternating weeks, and then it's £60. So I was getting like 100 odd pound every other week, which was more money than what I'd had before because my allowance was £15 a week, which was still very generous of social services to give you that. But it just seemed like such a brilliant, they were waving the golden ticket, weren't they? Like, police are going to stop looking for you. You can be independent and move in with this man. Do it. So that's what I did, and it was the dumbest thing I'd ever done. So
I mean, I guess in some ways, where just to get a sense of the world around you, where was your adoptive family in all of that? Were they sort of, because you're in care at this stage, they was there a connection there? Was there a relationship at all?
there was a connection there that was, it hadn't quite dwindled there yet. It was still a connection. My first birthday out of foster care, in foster care, sorry, because went into foster care right before my birthday. So my first birthday, we had it in like a McDonald's, which was nice. It was what it was. It was, well, it sounds pretty morbid. It was pretty morbid, but it was nice to have my family there. They were supporting where they can, but I remember in the hospital where, because the hospital had to keep me transferring from foster care because there was nowhere for me to live. So they'd all refused to have me. So I was holding on to that grudge. I was very much a child that held on to grudges. Like, if you'd wronged me, that was it. You're on my death list. So yeah. Sorry, whenever I laugh, I cough now. They were in the picture, but they weren't really anybody that I'd confide in or trust. And they all really, really liked the person I was moving in with because they thought that this individual was doing me good. They were helping sorting me out. They were supporting me. I'd stopped running away. I was actually settled somewhere. So they actually really liked him. I remember my adopted nan when things kind of ended and I went into supported accommodation after that because I was still 17. She was like, "It's so sad. He did you so well. He was so good for you." And it's like, yeah, but you understand he's not the same age as my adopted father, but he is the same age as my biological father, right? Like, you can comprehend this one, that this is exploitation. Like, I don't understand what a man that age has in common with a 16-year-old, that they don't, that it's not an equal power of exchange. Like, I can say this now, coming out of the situation and learning about exploitation and abuse and all of this, which I've got to make clear, never laid a hand on me, was not abusive, but it was the exploitation area that was definitely a form of abuse. But we're not talking physical abuse with that one. Yeah, they were still in the picture. They didn't leave the picture until I turned about 19, which is when I went no contact with them. I just said I can't do this anymore. A lot had gone on. I'd left a supported accommodation. I was homeless for a little bit. None of them offered to house me when I was homeless. In fact, some of them have turned around and said that they didn't even know I was homeless, which that they knew, that they all knew. But whether you want to admit that you knew or not is another subject. So by the time I was 19, I was done with them. But in my mind, I'd met my biological family by that point. So that was my new family, not realizing how that would go.
So had that been, I mean, I'm thinking again, it's a complicated picture, I guess. And but had you how would had you always sort of looked to your biological family? Had it always been in your mind that you wanted to go and see them?
especially after my relationship with my adopted dad had broken down and my adopted mom had died. I remember as a child, recreating scenes of when me and my adopted mom see each other and we'd just run and hug, and I'd pretend that she was like the bed frame or something, and I'd just hug the bed frame, and that would be how we reconnect. Just really dumb kid stuff that just never happens, because that isn't what reality is. Let's face that one. I'd always thought about them, especially after my adopted mom died. She would be my new mom. She would be my mom, because every little girl needs a mom, was what was always going through my head. So they'd always been there. My biological father, sorry, has a very distinctive surname. So when I'd left foster care, I managed to get a Facebook account and I found him pretty much straight away. So I'd had contact with him since I was 16, 17. It took me a bit longer to find my biological mother because she was in prison at the time that I was trying to find her. As I said, she was an extremely exploited child. I'd never hold anything that she did against her because of the childhood that she had. She's not responsible for the stuff that she's in prison for at all. And well, she's actually out of prison now, I believe, but that's by the by. We don't speak now. We don't really have much communications, just because we're very different people. I think we forget with re one thing I never appreciated with reunification is that we're strangers. I thought she'd have that maternal bond with me that all mothers claim to have, and she didn't, and neither did my biological father, in all fairness. We were adults and strangers. We didn't know each other, and they both got other children, especially my especially my biological father. He's very happy with the other children that he's got. So
I mean,
yeah, no.
that paints a really complicated picture of you by the time you're 19, 20, where you've kind of been, you're out of one family. I'm trying to think of polite ways of putting it. You're no longer part of this adoptive family. You've reconnected with your biological family, but that's nowhere near what you'd maybe dreamt of as the 8-year-old. So that's quite a, I mean, that's a lonely place, is it? Am I putting words in your mouth?
No, it sucked eggs is a polite way of putting that one. It was lonely. I had friends and people around me, but my emotional needs weren't being met, my physical needs. It was from the age of 16, from whenever really. I'd say, yeah, foster care, you get yourself up, you do it yourself, and then that just kind of, it's supposed to build resilience and teach children for aging out of the system, but it doesn't, in my opinion. It just teaches loneliness and how to make introverts, which is what I turned into. I used to internalize every, by this point, I was internalizing every feeling and taking it out on my body instead of the world around me. I tried to end my life so many times. I actually lost count after a bit. It was just overdose after overdose after overdose after overdose. It's slit and wrists, you name it, whichever way I could figure out that was what I was trying. Obviously nothing worked, thank God. But yeah, it was lonely, it was sad, it was isolating. I mean, as well, paying bills by yourself at 17, I was working, but I was on a child's wage, so I didn't have enough to go out and socialize. I didn't have enough really to eat every day. To put a 17-year-old through deciding whether to heat their home or to eat is insane. It's just madness. And there wasn't support, there wasn't help, which some of it through my own doing and some of it through other people around me. But yeah, no, lonely is a good word to use with that one. It was
It
lonely.
seems like an understatement. So can you describe then how, what turned that ship onto a different course? Because obviously you're here, you're speaking to me now. I know you've some of those relationships are rekindled and sound healthy. So tell me, how did you get, what changed?
I moved. I hit rock bottom after leaving to, well, I got married to somebody actually when I was 18. No, the 20, yeah, I've got the dates tattooed to my hand. I got married to somebody who wasn't an inappropriate age, but I was 18 by that point, so I don't really, and that completely broke down. I found out they'd had an affair the day, well, I found out about the affair the day before our wedding anniversary, our paper wedding anniversary. So you couldn't even leave it a year. Like, could you? So, and they weren't nice to me. I mean, that was physically abusive. And then I jumped into another relationship. Well, I got addicted to drugs in the meantime. And then I jumped into another relationship when I started to get sober. Once again, they were abusive. That person's now a convicted paedophile because of historic events. And then I just hit rock bottom after that, after realizing that somebody that I could love so much has not only violated my body in the abuse that they used to do to me, but it's also, it wasn't really my body that was the straw. It was the fact that you violated a minor that was the straw. Like, I have a lot more self-respect than that. Like, you can do what you want to me, but that child was innocent. So I left that. I moved in with some friends who were very kind in having me. I was living in their child's playroom because that was the only bed they had, which was lovely. And then through them, I met my partner now, who lives up north. I'm not going to give more than a location of that. I mean, and we built. I asked him one day because I got fed up of living there. I said, "Do you want to get a flat together as friends? We won't do anything more." We weren't together at that point. We were pretty much strangers. We'd only met twice, and they were like, "Yeah, absolutely, let's do this." 6 months later, I moved up north. That was almost 3 years ago now. Turned my life around completely. I know this sounds really silly, but the first, like, few nights we'd spent together, it was the best euphoric feeling you could feel. Like, you felt like you were home, and that's honestly what it felt like. We built a relationship together, and we built a family together. And, well, not children, but we've got, I class this as my family. This is my beautiful family. The first birthday I had up north there, my partner's family threw me a surprise birthday party, had banners and balloons. My sister-in-law made me birthday Smarty cookies because I don't like cake. And it was, you know, the love you wish you had as a child that you could feel from certain relatives, but not all the time. It was that love and acceptance that you needed. So, like, my partner actually swears around his parents and, like, says all sorts to his parents that, like, I couldn't even imagine saying to mine. Like, that's, you don't say that. What are you doing? And it taught me confidence. He's never hit me, which it does amazing for people's confidence. I've had no broken bones or sexual assaults from this partner, to be quite honest, which you'd be surprised what that does for somebody's confidence. They're just, poured confidence and love into me, which is what should have happened all along. And now I'm thriving, actually. I got myself into a red brick university. I'm the only one in my adopted family to get into a red brick. So, guess who won the university game? So, I'm doing psychology. I want to become a doctor in the future to help adult adoptees go through their own traumas and process their own stuff, because I think that's really important. I might venture out to children.
I mean, it's a remarkable story, and it feels like there's so many folds and kind of nuances and layers to so much of the stuff. And when you look back across it, how do you feel about adoption now? Because it's given you a lot, but it's taken a lot. There's been not a lot of unicorns or rainbows.
No. I want to be perfectly clear that I'm not a professional. My only opinion comes from lived experience. Well, I'm
That's
not a professional yet.
pretty
My
damn good.
only.
We'll take it as that. That's a good enough. You don't need to qualify it.
In my opinion, I can only find a few cases which I can actually count on my hands where adoption was the answer and the only answer. These are extremely exploited children that had to go into witness protection and then get adopted. They had to have their entire identity changed. The reasons why I was taken off my biological mother was because it sounds, to be quite honest, like she had postpartum psychosis. It sounds like I was her first child as a child. She was a child when she got pregnant with me. She had me, and instead of supporting her, they used to, I can imagine it in the mother and baby units with her being on one-to-one. Every time she interacted with me, someone just writing down in the book, because the notes I've got in my files from that mother and baby unit are very in-depth. And you would have to be seriously staring at somebody for that. I don't think that's an environment where people would feel comfortable being themselves or even raising a child, which, of course, that's what social had decided was safest for me to be in there with her. I don't think adoption is the answer in all cases, especially when we've got kinship, special guardianships. I think there's so many better ways in which a child can receive love and support without having their identity changed and their records changed, which isn't the fault of social services. It's the fault of the laws that are in place at the moment. Adoption isn't the answer. It causes trauma. I think a lot of adopted parents forget that in order to get an adopted child, trauma and relinquishment must have first occurred. As Paul Sunderland said, you don't just get an adoption through happy circumstances. And a lot of the circumstances and the reasoning they're giving in now is potential risk of future harm, not even future harm. Now, I'm not saying that children need to be harmed in order to get a safe and happy home, but the potential risk of future harm. So no harm has occurred by that point. Otherwise, they would have said harm. You're just concerned about harm. I think tragic big cases such as Baby P, which tragic, should never have happened. That child, in my opinion, was failed. But they've pushed, and those cases have pushed through the media more so than the, look, a biological parent didn't murder their child. Oh, my life. Because obviously that doesn't sell, does it? I mean, loads of parents don't hurt their children, though those stories don't sell. But it's what has fueled the numbers in adoption that we're seeing. And as well, they've made it a supply and demand. Whenever you look at adoption numbers and Adoption UK and other such companies like the UK government, and when they post how many adoptions have happened per year, they'll always underneath, there'll be number of adoption applications per year, therefore making it supply and demand. Because if you've got your number of adoptions lower than your applications, that puts the demand on the supply of infants. I think there's better options out there.
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm not after you to qualify your opinion. You don't have to. It's, you know, it's your opinion. You've lived it, so you can. It's absolutely justifiable. Courtney, thank you so much for sharing your story. And hopefully, it's not the end of the story, is it? It's just, it feels like it's the end of this chapter, and maybe it's the start of a new chapter, which is really exciting. And wish you well, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me on.